Our next argument this morning is Agnini against Charles Leedy Circulating. Mr. Tanner.
Thank you, Judge Easterbrook. May it please the court, counsel. Sherlock Holmes once famously said, "When you eliminate all other possibilities, what remains, no matter how improbable, is the answer." When an employer in a discrimination case changes its claimed non-discriminatory basis for an employment decision over and over and over again, only to either abandon each one or to back away from it when the evidence shows that it is likely not true, one is led to the truth that the likeliest outcome is that they have done what they are being sued for having done. The law reflects this wisdom. The Reeves versus Sanderson Plumbing case holds that where a plaintiff comes up with a prima facie case and sufficient evidence exists from which a reasonable finder of fact could conclude that the employer's stated non-discriminatory reason for its action is false, the trier of fact is permitted to conclude that the employer unlawfully discriminated. This court has held that since the Reeves case, in an opinion that Judge Rovner authored, the O'Neill versus City of New Albany case, and actually it had been the law in this circuit even before, in another opinion that Judge Rovner authored, the Stalter versus Walmart Stores case. Here you have a case where an employer begins by telling the state investigative agency when the question comes up, why did you hire new drivers and you didn't rehire the driver you had previously laid off? They said, we didn't hire drivers, we hired driver helpers, that's something different. It later turns out that in fact they had hired drivers, they had hired four drivers. And the story changes again and again. They file a sworn interrogatory answer stating that the ask to state all of the reasons for the failure to rehire. They state, our contract does not require us to rehire, which is true but irrelevant, and we have some sort of policy of not rehiring. A little more discovery goes on, and it turns out that, in fact, the only policy they have, a policy in writing, in fact, says that they will consider previously laid off employees for rehire. And there is evidence from the decision maker in this case that, in fact, the employer recognized that there was no conflict between that written policy and the collective bargaining agreement that governed the drivers, and that accordingly the company had every right to decide whether or not to rehire a previously laid off driver. Then the story changes one more time. Now it becomes, well, we have an agreement with the union. It's an informal agreement. Nobody quite knows where it comes from. Nobody can ever point to anybody previously being laid off from this company or from the decision maker's prior company that worked under the same collective bargaining agreement. But we had an agreement with the union that we would not recall previously laid off employees.
Why isn't the union a co-defendant in this case in view of the company's avowed reliance on union referrals?
I'm glad you asked, Judge Rovner. It's the avowal of reliance on the union came up very late in the case. The union was also a party to the EEOC proceeding.
I saw that in your footnote.
When, for whatever reason, I have no idea, the right to sue letter against Charles Leavy was issued well before the one regarding the union. We filed suit against Leavy. I don't want to misstate the fact, but I believe that we had already engaged in preliminary discovery and learned that Levy's story was the reason we didn't rehire him is because the contract didn't require it, because we have an internal policy that forbids it. Leavy had also answered sworn interrogatories stating that when we recruit drivers, we do so not just from the union, but also from other sources. By the time the right to sue letter came down against the union, it was frankly my judgment that there was no point in going after the union because the employer seemed to be taking responsibility for the decision, albeit taking responsibility in a manner that calls the company's truthfulness into question. The first time that the argument was ever made that the company failed to rehire Mr. Zaccanini solely because of a long-standing, unwavering practice of relying on the union for referrals came in the reply brief on summary judgment. And at that point, the union was long gone from the scene. I guess my basic point here, though, is that the story has changed so very many times. The law so very clearly tells us that when the story changes that many times, in most instances there is going to be enough justification for a finder of fact to conclude that the employer is coming up with pretexts for unlawful discrimination, and that should have been the case here. Summary judgment was not appropriately granted. I have reserved a good chunk of my time for rebuttal, and I'll keep it that way unless the court has other questions. I'll simply ask that the judgment below be reversed and the case be remanded for trial.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mr. Stevenson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Todd Stevenson, and I represent the appellee, Chaz Levy Circulating Company. There is one explanation that Mr. Tanner simply ignores because he cannot eliminate it because it is established by the undisputed evidence, and that is that decision maker Kevin King hired in the summer of 1997 the four individuals who were recommended by the union that there is no evidence that Mr. Zaccanini was recommended for hire by the union, that none of the 10 individuals who were let go in the spring of 1997 along with Mr. Zaccanini, all of whom were younger than Mr. Zaccanini, were not either rehired or even considered for rehire, and that there's no evidence that decision maker Kevin King ever considered anyone who didn't come from the union.
You know, when asked to identify the methods of recruitment it used in 1997, the company stated that union referrals were merely one of three methods. Why isn't that interrogatory answer inconsistent with the company's position now? It only obtained drivers from the union.
It's not inconsistent with the company's position, which is, Your Honor, that Mr. King only obtained drivers from the union. Mr. King was not hired by the company until April of 1997, after Mr. Zaccanini had initially been let go in the RIF. And there is no evidence that Mr. King, who's the decision maker here, and whose conduct is the only conduct that is relevant here, ever looked for a driver anywhere than other than from the union. In addition, they've admitted
Why did you affirmatively state in discovery that union referrals were merely one of three means of recruiting new employees in 1997?
We stated that because the interrogatory asked for all of 1997 and did not simply ask what was the basis on which you obtained the individuals who were hired for the four challenge position in the summer of 1997. There is no inconsistency, Your Honor, and that's particularly true when you realize that they do not dispute the four people at issue here came from the union, that Mr. Zaccanini's name did not come from the union, and that none of the other people were rehired. In fact, there should be no inference of discrimination even to explain here. This never should have gotten beyond a prima facie case, because this court has made clear, Radu is one case where it did so, that simply pointing to a younger person who was treated better is not enough. That younger person has to be similarly situated in all respects, and the fact that Mr. Zaccanini was not recommended by the union, while all four individuals who were hired undisputedly were referred by the union, when that's coupled with the fact that none of the 11 people who were let go in the spring of 1997 were recalled, makes clear that Mr. Zaccanini is not similarly situated and no inference of discrimination should ever have arisen. Now,
why would a company make it a practice never to hire a driver that has previously laid off?
It has that practice, according to the record, because the practice in this industry has consistently been, as long as anyone can remember, that all the employers get drivers from Local 706, and those drivers are recommended by the union secretary treasurer, Tony Judge. And Mr. Judge testified in his deposition that he's not aware of any driver in the 40 years he's been with that union who has ever been rehired by a company with a contract with Local 706. The procedure, it's essentially like a hiring hall, Your Honor. When driver vacancies come up, Mr. King and other companies that have contracts with Local 706 request that Mr. Judge forward
this
names to them.
He's a powerful man, isn't he?
Yes, he is. There's no question about that, Your Honor.
Sounds like an antitrust violation almost, doesn't it?
The union runs a hiring hall. Mm-hmm. And that is the way this industry is always run.
And the unions have been politically successful in getting hiring halls exempted from the antitrust laws.
Yes, they have. But the key issue here, Your Honor, is there's absolutely no evidence to dispute the way these individuals were hired. And that's that the four names came from the union. Mr. King hired them. Mr. Zaccanini's name didn't come from the union. And there is no evidence that anyone else, younger or older, was considered. Now, Mr. Zaccanini raises a number of other issues and says our story has changed in an effort to try to muddy the waters. He first of all says that when Chaz Levy was before the EEOC, it said we didn't hire drivers. There's a number of things you have to remember. First of all, the individual there was not decision maker, Mr. King. Second of all, what that individual said is in fact true, and Mr. Zaccanini himself admitted on page 39 of his deposition that when Chaz Levy hires drivers, they start out as driver helpers, and it's only after they're trained and become accustomed to driving that they're moved into the driver position and thereupon compensated under the union contract. As driver helpers, they're paid $8 an hour. They're not under the union contract. When they move into driver positions, they are paid under the union contract. So both because this wasn't a statement by Mr. King and in no way contradicts what he said, and because it's undisputedly true, it does not demonstrate that any reason has changed.
Well, let's talk about the human resources coordinator who said that CLCC, I think this was alluded to earlier, rarely contacts the union for applicants. And
right.
It's your position that this is explained because there's a difference between recruitment and hiring policies. Why do you recruit at all if you only hire from the union?
I think the way the answer to that interrogatory came up is that there are some people who may walk in the door, however, they're not hired that way. Hiring has to go through the union. But I think you're referring to what Mr. Eckert allegedly said. And again, it's only what the investigator reports that he said, that there people were rarely obtained from the union. Again, he's not the decision maker.
Well, I just don't understand why there's any recruitment at all. If you only get from, you call the big guy at the union, he's the one that gives everybody the goal. Why, there shouldn't even be recruitment.
You could save a lot of money here.
Well, again, Mr. Canner propounded an interrogatory, and we attempted to answer his interrogatory, which asked for all of 1997 in a truthful manner, and it is the case that people at times walk in, and
odd,
we consider that to be recruitment.
It just seems odd, knowing what the issues were in the case and the specific allegations, that this policy came about so late in the game.
Well, Your Honor, it didn't come up so late in the game, and that's another issue I want to address. It did not first come up in our reply brief. It came up in the deposition of Kevin King, where, and this is at pages 23 through 25 of Mr. King's deposition, which was Exhibit A to our summary judgment materials, Mr. King expressly stated that he had always obtained every single driver that he'd ever gotten at Charles Levy and every driver he'd gotten working for the Tribune from the union.
Well, if ever there was anyone who has an irrelevant job, it is Mr. King.
He doesn't simply hire the individuals. He has operational responsibilities.
Well,
so
then that portion of his job, he would not be paid for it.
And I just want to make sure King was around. Just I want to make sure from a timing standpoint, he was around when the interrogatory was responded to.
He was. I'm not sure about that. I believe he may have been.
Right.
However, nothing in that interrogatory answer in any way tracks from the admission that all the people came from the union, that Zaccanini's name was not given by the union, and that. And I also want to mention briefly this quote-unquote written rehire policy. The evidence is that Mr. King didn't even know it existed, and there's no evidence it was ever applied to anyone in a driver position.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Tanner?
You know, when an employer tells the truth, it seldom needs to look in the rearview mirror. But Levy bumped up against itself time and time again. They're claiming that the reason they answered the interrogatory the way they answered it is because recruiting took place in some fashion during some portion of 1997, differently than what they're claiming Mr. King said was his practice when he came to the company. That would be fine, except that the company is also telling this court that the practice of relying solely on the union is not just with this company, but with every company covered by this contract, has been around for time immemorial, and I still don't get what portion of 1997 that doesn't cover. They say, well, we were talking about how we recruited during different portions of the year. The record reflects that there were a huge number of layoffs in March of 1997. There is nothing in the record to suggest that anybody was ever hired during any portion of 1997. They made the layoffs. They eventually concluded that they needed some more people, and those are the hires that we're talking about in this litigation. There is no basis for concluding that there was a different hiring policy earlier in the year than there was at the time when Mr. Zaccanini was trying to come back. When it suits the company's purposes, they're quick to point out that Kevin King was not a decision maker, was not working at the company at the time certain things happened. At the time, Mr. Zaccanini was told by the guy who laid him off, yes, John, we will be happy to take you back as soon as we're in a position to add drivers. They're happy to disassociate themselves from that because Mr. King didn't work there at the time. They also try to claim that when these layoffs occurred, there couldn't have been discrimination because many younger guys were laid off. They try to say that the company couldn't have been discriminating on the basis of age because they had hired Mr. Zaccanini just a couple of years earlier. But the fact is, Mr. King, the decision maker, was not there at the time that any of those things happened, so they really can't get any benefit out of the fact that Mr. King was not there. It has been stated time and again that the union never submitted Mr. Zaccanini's name. That was never stated in discovery. It was never stated in the summary judgment papers until the reply brief. And when it was cited in the reply brief, it referred to something in the reply local fact rule section that contains no citation to any evidence. There is no evidence in the summary judgment record that the union did not give Mr. Zaccanini's name to the company.
And then just in terms of timing, King was around when the interrogatories were answered.
Judge, he worked there. He held that position at the time.
That's what I want to know.
Absolutely. There are too many questions here to be able to say that no reasonable fact finder could conclude that Levy did not do what they're being accused of doing, and for that reason I would ask that the court reverse the grant of summary judgment. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Miller. Sorry, Mr. Tanner.